Hello and welcome to Symposium of the Lotus Eaters number 6. I'm joined today by Harry.
Hello.
And we are going to talk about Carl Schmitt's criticism of liberalism. Now, Carl Schmitt was a controversial figure who was born in West Germany in 1888 and died in 1985, I think.
Yeah, ripe old age of, I think, 96. Very, very good age to get to.
And he was a German conservative who was also a legal theorist, a constitutional theorist, and is also known for some of his contributions to politics, particularly the friend-enemy distinction that we are going to talk about today. So one of the things that immediately strikes us when we read about Carl Schmitt is that he was a controversial figure. Like some other thinkers, like Martin Heidegger, they associated themselves with the Nazi Party.
Yes, I believe it was in early 1933, May 1st. I don't know if that was before or after Hitler was elected as Chancellor. He joined the Nazi Party and began to support them very publicly. I think he supported the burning of the of certain Jewish texts and the books and such. So he was very much all in for a time. Later on, he ended up distancing himself a bit from the Nazi Party after they ended up disavowing him and saying that he was trying to spread anti-Nazi propaganda. They did that in their own state-run newspaper. So he decided, well, they don't like me anymore. I'm just going to step aside for a while. He ended up getting interviewed, well, interrogated in Nuremberg. And whatever, I've not read the transcripts that are available online, but whatever it was that he said during those interrogations did end up getting him acquitted.
Yeah. So the thing is that it seems to me that one of the major traumas that he had, I mean, intellectually speaking, was the loss of World War I for Germany. And it seems that he was very much interested in the adverse effect that the League of Nations had for Germany and the terms that they were trying to imposing on Germans. And in the early 20s, he wrote most of his famous works, or at least the first one.
Yeah, in the Weimar period.
Some of them are political theology,
which I have here. These are the two works, main works that we'll be discussing here today. Political theology, which came first of the two of these, and then the concept of the political. He does have a lot of other writing beyond that, including before both of these came out, a book which is available in an English translation, I've just found out, on dictatorship.
Yeah.
But these are the two main works that he has which have contributed to modern political theory. And these were both kind of unearthed in the Western canon, shall we say, in the 1980s with the advent of thinkers like Paul Gottfried and people examining the work of Leo Strauss, who did commentary on Schmitt's work. Basically, a lot of Jewish thinkers in the 1980s decided that they wanted to go back and look at his work, because despite, obviously, the very radical beliefs he ended up espousing in the 1930s and 40s, they look at his work and go, okay, there is a lot of really useful political analysis that we can take from this.
It's really interesting to point out that he was primarily a legal scholar. So he's viewing things from a lawyer's perspective.
All over both of these works, constant references to jurisprudence, other jurists in the of Germany at the time. There is, and I will say this just straight away, just as a little note, a pin to put on this conversation, which is some of the more explicitly juridical discussions that go on throughout this went straight above my head. There is a discussion in the second essay on this, because this is a selection of four very short essays that he wrote at the time, called The Problem of Sovereignty, where he looks through some of the other arguments about what sovereignty is, where it originates from, and some of the discussions were highly specific in the terminology used.
Yeah.
So there was a little bit of me just blanking through some of that. But when it comes to the other essays and such, I think I was able to understand them well enough to understand the arguments that I could extract from it that would be useful. And he also goes on for some relatively high-level terminology and discussion of other philosophical thinkers from the past. So if I misinterpreted anything, that's entirely on my lack of knowledge in some areas.
And it's interesting again to point out that his influence has been he always had an underground influence. But many people, especially in the Anglosphere, have rediscovered his work, as you said, from the 80s.
Yes.
Both from left and right. And many leftists interpret his work as a really strong defense of the claim that economic liberalism leads to authoritarianism. That's the way they try to, that's what they think he shows.
That's definitely not exactly what I got. I think he, from what I was able to understand through reading this, he sees the whole prescription of liberalism as some kind, as a anathema to civilization. Yeah. Whereas if they're just trying to take the economic argument, they're missing that he is also giving a social argument, the idea of the, as with many illiberal thinkers, the idea of the atomized individual, this individualism based around turning the individual into the entire center of all social and political action, is very damaging to society, is his argument. And leftists taking his economic argument in support of the argument of even further atomization of the individual to the point where you're living in the pod, eating the boogs, is not what he was intending here.
Okay, so before we start talking about his concept of sovereignty and his account of the enemy and friend distinction, I want to ask you whether you think we should read controversial figures, because there are some, personally, I like reading everyone. I like, you know, I just like reading. And I think that the philosophy has and political theory has lots of things to absorb. And we should never forget their teachings. And even if there are some people who go really wrong, it is interesting to see how they go wrong. And remember that they were people who lived in real life circumstances and something led them to believe that. But there is also another idea that some people have, that what we read affects how we think, and how we think affects how we act. So what we read affects how we act.
There is definite truth to that second statement, because reading through illiberal thinkers, the fact of the matter is what you are reading is their arguments against liberalism. And whether or not you end up agreeing with their prescriptions at the end of their argumentation, the arguments themselves will challenge your beliefs. They will affect the way that you think, and they will get you to possibly look at things from a different perspective than what you were examining things through at the time, to the point where going through a lot of these illiberal thinkers, and I think the one who kind of started me out on this, ironically being that he is an anarcho-capitalist libertarian, is somebody like Hopper, who, despite being a libertarian, is one of the most illiberal thinkers operating in discourse today, I would say. And then going on that has led me to the point where I'm no longer a libertarian. I would probably not even consider myself a liberal anymore. But I do think we should be able to read and discuss very controversial figures, because once again, whether or not, I certainly don't believe in the same conclusions that people like Schmitt came to, because Schmitt definitely came to a conclusion, given the party that he ended up supporting in the 1930s. While I've not ended up at that same conclusion as him, it has allowed me to look at liberalism and the world that we live in through a different light, which has made me fall out of favor with that, shall we say. But despite that, yeah, we should definitely let people read controversial topics, but I do think it's good to be careful. I think if you're reading particularly radical works, and you know that somebody is going to read these who is potentially, shall we say, in a period of their life where they're going to be very susceptible to falling into radical ideologies, it will be good.
And radicalization,
Yeah, it will be good to help to direct these people, not in an authoritarian, not in a nudge theory sort of way. Just if you know somebody who's very, very susceptible to radicalization, as you said, if you know that they're reading something that could easily radicalize them in a very negative way, maybe also point them to other thinkers so that they can counterbalance it. Like, for instance, when I was in my kind of ANCAP phase, I was basically just reading that.
Yeah.
And it did affect the way that I was thinking. And people suggested, hey, maybe you should try and balance it out a little bit. And in doing so, it kind of got me out of some of the crazier ideas that they were putting forward.
That's what I wanted to point out, because it seems to me that it's very healthy to have a diverse, let's say, list of readings. Because
the only diversity that is important, by the way.
And it's important to have a diversity of readings, because otherwise we are susceptible to a form of brainwash. So for instance, if we were in Maoist China and the only thing we could read was
The Little Red Book,
that wouldn't be nice.
No, it wouldn't. But after a certain
but
point,
but we shouldn't forget the Little Red Book. Because
no, of course not. I think it's important to recognize that even in the Little Red Book, there might actually be some good advice we can take from it.
Or it could
I've
be.
I've not read it. It probably isn't, but still, there might be in there.
Or even if there is no good advice there, it's important to remember that sometimes people can go awfully wrong.
Yeah.
And it's good to, as you said, to read across the board and familiarize ourselves with various perspectives, because otherwise we just have a really one-sided intellectual diet.
Yeah, I hate to invoke Mill, but he was absolutely right when he said that engaging with arguments that we disagree with can help us to strengthen our own arguments and our own understandings.
Yeah. Yes. And one thing I wanted to ask you before we move to Smith's concept of sovereignty that will help our discussion is that let us try and define liberalism and libertarianism a bit better, because when we're talking about Smith's critique of liberalism, it is important to have the site to be mindful of what kind of liberalism he has in mind and how the notion has changed today.
So, yes, this is important, and I would argue actually very Schmittian, because he does point out in the concept of the political that political concepts, as stated, like an ideology like liberalism, is specific to a time and place. It's the way that we can see, for instance, the classical liberals are trying to adhere to a liberalism which does compart more with the 19th century understanding of the term, whereas modern liberalism is more in line with the progressive early 20th century developments that took place mainly in America.
So, and by the way, I think there was also this social liberalism in the early 20s.
Oh, very much so in the Weimar period.
But also in Britain, there is a really interesting writer called Leonard Hobhouse.
I think I've heard that name before.
Yeah,
maybe
he was writing in the
20s. Eric Hobsbawm's
name. Okay, yeah. Okay, so let us talk about Schmitt's concept of sovereignty. Schmitt is called the Hobbes of the 20th century, I think.
Well, he does constantly refer to Hobbes, so that is understandable.
And he has this idea that laws are not made by moral truth, they're made by force, which is very Hobbesian. I think that was a Hobbesian quote.
Perhaps.
Or I may have paraphrased
it
a bit.
I've not read Hobbes myself, so I can't really comment on it, sadly.
We should definitely have a conversation on Hobbes at some point.
Well, I'm going to read Aristotle next, and I think Hobbes will be coming up. We've got a copy of Leviathan in the office. So.
Okay, so Schmitt is really interested in this idea of the state of exception, because he says that it's fine to talk about a state in general and the general rules that people follow, but what happens when there really is a problem? Or, for instance, when an invasion takes place or when social anarchy takes place. And it seems to me that he started with this idea of a state of exception or a state of emergency, and that was the way in which he entered into the discussion.
That's true. I think he was probably examining the times that he lived in and basically considered himself to be living in a time of emergency, given the Weimar situation, obviously hyperinflation, and also, let's be perfectly honest as well, rampant social degeneracy that was going on, especially in metropolitan centers like Berlin at the time.
So the thing is, he has this argument against the liberal constitutional legal order, which we could somehow paraphrase in the following way. So he says, a functioning legal order requires effective laws. Effective laws require a bearer of sovereign authority. Liberal constitutionalism has no way to accommodate a bearer of sovereign authority. Therefore, liberal constitutionalism cannot sustain a functioning legal order. Before we evaluate this argument, I want to say that liberal constitutionalism is supposed to be the idea that we are living in a society with a constitution, for those of you who don't know, that gives a sort of template of general rules that should be followed and that they are not easily revocable in the way that other pieces of legislature can be in a democracy. So, for instance, when we have a constitutional parliamentary democracy, there typically are some issues that we cannot discuss or vote on and change immediately. Maybe we could. Parliament is going
Bill
to
Bill of Rights, Second Amendment is unbreachable. For instance, you're not able to do anything that would ruin the Second Amendment, like do things like just ban guns in the US outright. That's not something that should be allowed to happen outside of a massive deliberation.
And constitutionalism is supposed to be the system of checks and balances into power. And the main idea behind constitutional thinking is that power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely, as Lord Acton said, and that there should be the best way of controlling power is to have separation of powers and have each power checking the other. So, for instance, we have the legislative branch, the executive branch of government, and the judiciary branch. So there is this idea that the power should not be controlled. But this seems to be a problem for Schmitt.
Well, I think the problem that he would bring up in the concept of the political is that the fact of the matter is that those institutions that you set up that are supposed to be these separate branches of power, such as I'm sure we all know that we're referring to the US government, the federal system that they have there, the problem is that no institution can be neutral on the face of it, because that institution will be manned by individuals that will have their own biases, that will have their own preferences. And I think one of the things that he brings up throughout the concept of the political as well is that this is kind of an attack on the idea of rule of law as the ultimate standard that we need to hold things by, because he points out, and a few other thinkers who are referenced throughout this point out, I think Max Weber in particular is somebody that he refers to throughout both of these texts, is the idea that rule of law is basically the rule of bureaucracy. And bureaucracy, if we were to apply a rule of law on the face of it as it is conceptualized, that being the idea of you don't have any bias in the system, it's just the laws, everybody has those laws applied to them equally, that would require a vast bureaucratic mechanism to be able to enforce it in such a way. And bureaucracy, on the face of it, is in kind of an inhuman way of going about things. So he would probably argue, at the same time, you want people in those systems to add a bit of humanity into it. Hence why, by the end of political theology, for instance, he is arguing basically for the dictator, that being somebody who can add the human individual touch back into the system that is being removed. I do think he is a bit wrong in the idea that... I do think he is a bit wrong in the idea that liberal constitutionalism completely removes the human element from it. I think on the public level, it does, because all you need to do is go on social media and see NPC behavior, shall we say, to see that people just assume that the system works, the system operates in an impersonal and objective way. I don't think it does. I think we should all know, just from covering the news constantly, that there is a hell of a lot of bias that goes into this, that there are individual actors who are very negative. So the argument I've seen from other illiberal thinkers closer to the modern period has been that liberalism doesn't destroy these mechanisms, it just shrouds them.
So if the problem with a constitution, according to Schmitt, or with a constitutional liberal order, is that we have biased agents within each power, why would it be a solution to put a biased agent to have ultimate and sovereign authority over people?
Well, that's...
Isn't that supposed to be one of the things that the constitutional liberal order is supposed to guard against? Well, the possibility of internal enemies.
That's true, but the problem is that I don't think there can be any order come to from first principles that would be able to eliminate any bias whatsoever. So the solution seems to be, and he refers to Bonosso Cortez, who's a writer I've not read the works of, but he also refers to De Maistre and a few other people in the last essay of this, which is basically you want... In that case, what you want is somebody in charge who's your friend, in terms of that friend-enemy distinction.
I wonder whether this is a good way of thinking about constitutional orders, because on the one hand, we can talk about the illusion that, you know, you have a constitution, we can have a constitution, and it will take care of all the rest. I think that would be an illusion. And many people, as you point out, well, they do think that, and they do have this idea that we're essentially passive beings. All we need is to have wise institutions and they'll take care of of all the rest. I would reject that. But I think there can be another defense of constitutional orders precisely on the grounds that there are biased people. So just because there are biased people, we don't want them to have sovereign authority.
No, that's fair. But I would also say that I don't think there's any practical way of truly mitigating that outside of having a supercomputer AI run everything. But even then, you run into the problem of the inhumanity of such a thing. Yeah. Would we want that? Because when it comes to the decision, which is what he bases the idea of sovereignty around, the decision to suspend all valid and normal legal operations and instead put ultimate power in the place of one man or one group of people, what decisions would that AI make? And would it have already been biased by the people who are programming it in the first place? So there's problems with that. I think this sort of absolutism is very familiar because he's, from looking into his background, he was raised Catholic. He was raised by Roman Catholic parents. He ended up getting excommunicated from the church in the 1920s because he had previously gone through a divorce and got remarried. So they decided that's not on.
That's a big no-no.
Yeah, that's a very big no-no for the Catholics. But the other thinkers that he refers to as well, Demaistre, Cortes, are also Catholic. So this seems to be something very inherent within Catholic political thinking, or at least rightist Catholic political thinking, this idea of the absolutism. But I would also think that one of the problems that he has with constitutionalism, and seeing as he's referring to Demaistre, I can only assume that he has a similar perspective as Demaistre on this, is that the idea of coming up with the constitution from pure first principles and applying them purely as first principles, the a priori creation of principles, rather than Demaistre is very, very complimentary of the English constitution, the kind of unwritten constitution, being something that arose through political conflict and something that arose purely through experience. We have the constitution, we have these rules that we apply everything by, not because we just came up with them a priori and decided that they will work, but because we have experience demonstrating that they'll work. And I think to a certain extent, even the US Constitution operates in such a way because people try and take something like freedom of speech, freedom of religion in the First Amendment as being just this flat, blank, abstract principle that's supposed to be applied evenly to everyone. No, it was supposed to be applied evenly among a particular group of people at a particular time. The whole idea of the freedom of religion was supposed to be freedom to practice different sects of Christianity without the federal government getting involved. It wasn't supposed to be applied to really anybody else. But through the process of liberalization, that reality has been obfuscated to the point where all of a sudden they are just floating abstract principles, not particular to anybody.
Okay, so let us try to evaluate the argument. So the first idea or the first premise says a functioning legal order requires effective laws.
I think that's pretty, on the face of it, I think we can all agree with that.
I think we can definitely agree with this. And I mean, we cannot have society without law enforcement and a degree of coercion. The question is whether such coercion is justified.
Yeah, the only people who would really push back against that, I would imagine, are leftist anarchists.
Or people like Max Stirner's persuasion.
Yeah. I've not read Max Stirner. What would he have said about this?
Really weird, dude.
Okay. All right. We'll leave it there.
But what is interesting is that I don't see whether Schmitt is saying very much about what a law is or how he understands the law. I'm not talking about, you know, what is the law question, you know, like that. But
well, it's Judge Dredd, obviously.
Yeah, exactly.
He is the law.
Yeah. So the thing is, there are many kinds of laws, such as prohibitive laws or coercive laws. What is the kind of law that he has in mind? He seems to have in mind coercive laws.
I wouldn't really be able to say. Once again, some of the juristic arguments that he's going over, specifically in political theology, which I finished reading last night, The Concept of the Political, I read a few weeks ago, so this one's much clearer in my mind. I wouldn't really be able to say, because once again, he was a jurist and he was evidently responding to other jurists of his time. Perhaps there was an unwritten, implicit agreement between all of them of what they were referring to when they were speaking of particular laws. So I couldn't strictly say, but if we were to apply it in a general term, the general idea of laws, I think we can... No, I still don't. I'm not entirely sure.
Maybe I think a society requires both, because you could say that we have the law that says you should not murder. That's a prohibitive law. So long as you
it's
don't murder...
It's also a liberating law because it means that people aren't free to murder me.
Yeah. And I mean, coercive laws are laws like you should pay your taxes. Now, that's not definitely not close to heart.
Yeah. Could also be something like Section 127 of the Communications Act, which says you are not to offend people online. What's offense? It's just whatever people tell us it is.
So he seems to have in mind more coercive laws in mind, because the idea of a sovereign authority imposing a particular legal order, that seems to be a coercive thing. And he seems to think that the sovereign is simultaneously under the law and above the law.
Or is that a wrong way of putting it? I think the sovereign in his eyes is somebody, due to the fact that the sovereign is the person who can decide, who can make the decision, that being once again to suspend all normal legal order. By de facto, on the face of that, that is above the law. You are somebody who is above the law because you have the ability to suspend the law.
Okay. So, second premise is effective laws require a bearer of sovereign authority. I think that's really important, and I think that's right, because the problem with laws is that they refer to people who usually don't care about breaking them. So we could have unwritten laws, and there would be no law saying that you shouldn't murder if no one murdered.
Yeah, if everyone behaved themselves, you wouldn't need to write these down, codify them.
So the thing is that very frequently, people who break the law, maybe not always, but very frequently, people who break the law, they do have no concern of, you know, social cohesion, and they don't care about it. They just look at their own advantage.
And this is what leftists miss.
And they don't care at all about this. So the thing is that with people of this sort, you cannot debate. So you must be able to apply force and exercise coercion in order to save social cohesion and the freedoms of other people. So I think that's a fair point.
I think that is a fair point. And I think it also ties into something that we see a lot in the current period, which is people not applying the laws. We see police in riots in 2020 going out, arresting protesters / rioters, and these people go into jail for 5 minutes and then immediately get let out again. Yep. So there is no real sovereign in that situation enforcing the law, mandating it. I think it also applies to things like in...
Or worse, there is a sovereign and just...
Oh, and he chooses to abdicate responsibility. His decision is to not make a decision in that situation. And I think it also applies to... After reading The Age of Entitlement, there was some examples that Christopher Caldwell gave of legislation that was passed in the 1970s. I think it was a big immigration act, which was going to make it easier for people to get citizenship who had maybe got into the country illegally when the law was passed. But they were also going to really strictly enforce laws against people hiring and using illegal labor. And the reality of the matter was that what happened was that they really enforced the allowing people to get citizenship even though they'd broken into the country, but did not at all enforce the laws regarding people hiring illegal labor. So that's an example there. The sovereign chose to abdicate one decision, but chose to oversee the other decision. So that's just the fact that if you have laws, you need somebody to apply them. And if they're not going to apply them, then that law basically doesn't exist.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.